Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, last night, Democrats regained control of the House by getting a lot of votes in suburbs across the country. This win will give Democrats the power to prevent Republicans from passing even more tax cuts for the wealthy and slashing Social Security and other social programs. Republicans tightened their grip on the Senate, which gives them the power to confirm even more conservative judges. There were also many firsts last night. In the year 2018, we finally have Native American women in Congress. Democrat Charisse Davids won her seat in Kansas, and Democrat Deb Haaland won in New Mexico. Rashida Tlaib in Michigan is a Palestinian American, and Ilhan Omar in Minnesota is a Somali American. And at 29, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York will be the youngest woman ever to serve in Congress. But Donald Trump also won last night. His racist, xenophobic messages resonated in states he visited, including Missouri, where Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill and Indiana Senator Joe Donnelly lost their races. So what does all of this reveal about the state of the country and where we are going? Today, we are joined by Carrie Levine, senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit investigative news organization. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you. We're also joined by Kevin Robillard, senior politics reporter for the Huffington Post. Hi, Kevin. Thank you for joining us. Do we have Kevin? We'll get him in a minute. And Arisha Hatch, managing director of Campaigns for Color of Change, a collaborative team of activists committed to making justice real for Black people. Hi, Arisha. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first off, let's talk about the Democrats taking back control of the House, because this is very significant and important if you believe that there should be a check on power in Washington, D.C. Carrie, can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, I think that we are back to having a divided Congress, obviously, with Democrats in control of the House, Republicans maintaining control of the Senate. And so that sets up a situation that's going to be different from the first 2 years of the president's term. The House Democrats have suggested they're going to engage in some significant oversight. They're going to be investigating the administration, using the subpoena power that comes with control, requesting the president's tax returns, among other things. And so I think we're going to see the White House having to commit some resources to responding to that.
Also, Lee Fong from The Intercept was on last night, and he said this also really does save social programs, because if the Republicans had won the House, they would have seen that as a mandate to really go after things like Medicare and Social Security. They definitely would have tried to pass another tax cut for the wealthy. So that's also really significant.
Right. Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens on questions of spending and things like that, on the deficit and on social programs, because the two houses of Congress are obviously going to have to deal with the business of governing, even though they're not controlled by the same party.
Arisha, what are your overall thoughts on the significance of the Democrats taking back the House?
I think it's a big deal, although we obviously didn't get all that we wanted out of last night. Return to a system of checks and balances on at least a certain set of issues and a certain set of policies, I think, is incredibly important in terms of stopping the bleeding. But there's obviously lots of work left to do in order to regain power for progressives and for the community that I organize for, which are Black folks.
Right. And we talked about this a bit last night. We just didn't have enough information. Do we know more this morning? When you look at the Democrats who won their House seats, especially all of these women and people of color, obviously they have very different platforms. Some could be corporate Dems, some could be progressive Dems. But what do you know so far in terms of where these Democrats actually stand on issues?
I think so far we understand that especially a lot of the women candidates that we've seen succeed that they are progressive on issues. They're the types of candidates that will talk about ending mass incarceration and reforming the criminal justice system. They're the type of folks that will talk about Medicare, Medicaid for all. So we're definitely excited to see a wave of new progressives join with folks to push us to the next level. But again, as we, you know, we're still at Color of Change very much closely watching races in Florida and Georgia that we feel like are undecided, which could have impacts on how black and brown people within these states actually experience America.
Right. And we'll talk about that because as it stands right now, Stacey Abrams in Georgia is refusing to concede. Is that still the case?
Last I heard, that's the truth. And we think it's an incredibly important stance. She is a powerful candidate who has faced so many obstacles to election, from people saying that a black woman could never win the seat of governor, especially in Georgia, and to be running against Brian Kemp, who is the Secretary of State, who has an inherent conflict of interest and who did everything he could to make sure that black and brown voters were not counted or made it harder for them to vote in this election. And I just think it's incredibly important that progressives refuse to concede in this political climate. These elections can't be called by the news, and everything that we've seen in Georgia and some of the things that we've seen in Florida make us feel like there is more investigation warranted and no need for a quick concession.
Right. And we will talk about voter suppression in just a minute, but I wanted to bring Kevin into the show. Kevin, are you with us?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's Kevin Robillard. He's senior politics reporter with the Huffington Post. So can you talk about the significance of the Democrats taking back the House?
Yeah. This was their mission at the start of the 2018 cycle. There were a lot of sort of disappointments for progressives last night. Gillum, Abrams, Beto O'Rourke, all coming up short. But this was the Democratic Party's number one goal at the start of the 2018 cycle, was to win back control of the United States House of Representatives, and they did that. The most important thing that they'll probably get out of this is, for one, they essentially shut down the president's legislative agenda beyond sort of very big bipartisan things. There's going to be some chatter about some type of deal on infrastructure. I'm skeptical we can get done. The other thing is they now have the ability to really investigate Trump, investigate the various conflicts of interest, the various policies he's proposed. Republicans have done essentially no oversight of the Trump administration over the past 2 years, with very limited exceptions. And so I would expect that to quickly turn up. Once this new Congress is signed in, you're going to see a lot of subpoenas flying out to Trump administration officials.
And we talked about this with Arisha, but what's your read on the House winners last night? Are we seeing more progressive Democrats, more middle of the road, more corporate?
It's a mix. You're seeing in one of the trends that I think really did occur this year in the Democratic primary was in the safest blue seats, you really did see more progressive Democrats winning. I'm thinking of people like Ocasio-Cortez, people like Ilhan Omar, people like Rashida Tlaib. These are all very progressive Democrats, someone like Deb Haaland in New Mexico. That said, most of the winners in the swing districts are more middle of the road. Whether or not you want to call them moderate or establishment, I think would vary from winner to winner. Mm-hmm. Most of them are fairly mainstream Democrats, I would say. But they are not the sort of leftist progressives that are really going to be pushing the envelope. There are still a few who could win. Katie Porter, who is a protege of Elizabeth Warren, right now is trailing in a seat in California. Down in Orange County, she could still come back. The votes haven't been finished counting there. Some other progressives, Kara Eastman, who is in Omaha, who progressives got really excited about, really ran on Medicare for All. She lost last night. So really, it looks like it's more of a standard group of establishment Democrats in the swing seats, while progressives did probably move a lot of these safer blue seats a few notches to the left.
I just got a press release from Peace Action, a peace organization in the country. They work to elect pro-peace candidates. We don't hear that word very much these days, unfortunately. But Peace Action says they endorsed dozens of candidates for Congress. Many won, including Mike Levin, a Democrat in California, 49th District. We mentioned Rashida Tlaib, Democrat mm-hmm. Michigan, 13th District. Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. Tom Malinowski, New Jersey, a Democrat mm-hmm. there. And Chrissy Houlihan in Pennsylvania. And they're mm-hmm. they're just talking about nuclear weapons preventing war. You know, we talked about this last week, but Kevin, this is an issue that just didn't really get much attention. And yet we see massive military spending bills. Most Democrats vote for these bills. I mean, we did a show about Afghanistan, 17 years since the U.S. invasion there. Mm-hmm. Does anything stand out for you on this issue, especially U.S. foreign policy?
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that most stands out is the lack of conversation about it on the campaign trail. It is not something that comes up with voters. When I was out in different districts, these were red districts, blue districts, swing districts, it is not something voters bring up. They're very focused on domestic concerns. The number one thing was obviously health care. But it's not an issue that really comes up in Democratic primaries anymore. It occasionally comes up in Republican primaries, but it's not really a central issue. The one thing I will say is that Democrats did elect a number of veterans this year. And some of those veterans are fairly skeptical of sort of military adventurism. A lot of the candidates endorsed by vote vets are fairly skeptical of, you know, the wars they might have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that is one thing to potentially look at. Someone like Tom Malinowski was an Obama State Department official. He has expressed some skepticism about military adventurism. So I think there is, that might be an underreported aspect of this. But right now, you just don't hear a lot of conversation on the campaign trail about foreign policy. It's not something voters tend to ask candidates about. It's not something candidates really tend to bring up very much.
Well, it's something the media should talk about more. I mean, really. Carrie, do you have anything to add there on U.S. foreign policy?
You know, I think that it's everyone's concern. And I think right now you're seeing foreign policy being discussed in a lot of states in the context of trade and tariffs. As opposed to war. So obviously I am not at all minimizing the importance of war, and I certainly agree that it should be something on all of our minds. But I think what you saw is that the discussion during the campaign was to a considerable degree an economic one. It was about whether or not there was still an Asian market for soybeans and the effect of the president's trade policies and things like that. And I think that you really did see some messaging around that in certain states to differing effects. You know, I'd point you to the North Dakota Senate race where Senator Heitkamp, the incumbent Democratic senator who was running for re-election, really said, look, these trade policies are hurting North Dakota. They're hurting the Asian market for our agricultural exports. But the president endorsed U.S. Rep. Kevin Cramer, who won last night. And so clearly that was an argument that didn't hit home with North Dakota farmers. They decided to give the president a chance to have these policies play out.
And Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota lost by almost 10 points last night.
And that's correct. And I think that the polls, you know, had her down by a good amount. Mm. And she was really a big upset when she won in 2012. The polls had her down then, too. And so I think there were a lot of people thinking, well, she did it once. Maybe she'll do it again, but not this time.
And one more note on the Democrats in the House. We just got a press release from the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge. This is from Oil Change in the U.S., and their release says that in a sign of things to come, more than half of the new Democratic freshman class has signed the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge. Of the anticipated 34 new Democratic members, 19 have signed the pledge, which commits them to not take contributions from the oil, gas, and coal industry and instead prioritize the health of families, climate, and democracy over fossil fuel industry profits. In New Mexico, voters elected Stephanie Garcia Richard to public lands commissioner to oversee methane regulations. She's committed to stopping the expansion of fracking. Again, New Mexico voters elected Deb Haaland to Congress. She has pledged to vote against all new fossil fuel infrastructure in line with climate science and the Paris climate goal. She's also a strong advocate for indigenous rights. We talked about Ilhan Omar in Minnesota. She ran a fossil-free campaign. She spoke frequently about a just transition to build a clean energy economy. I mean, this is important to talk about the issues because we talk about the women, the people of color, which is great, but what do they actually stand for? Before we move on from the House, is there anything else, Arisha, that stands out for you about where these new candidates actually stand and what they plan to fight for?
I mean, I think we've talked about a lot. I think one of the themes that we also saw last night on election night was that there were real strides made in a number of places on criminal justice reform, from Amendment 4 in Florida, which restores voting rights to formerly incarcerated folks, many of whom are Black, that gained over 60% in a hugely bipartisan, multiracial sort of coalition of folks, as well as the election of a progressive prosecutor in Wesley Bell in St. Louis County, where the Ferguson uprisings took place. We're really seeing a new wave of politicians who are willing to take on an initiative that are willing to take on our criminal justice system in a new way, and so those will have huge impacts for Black communities in addition to the other candidates and issues that we've talked about already.
That is Arisha Hatch. She's a Managing Director of Campaigns for Color of Change. We're also joined by Carrie Levine, Senior Political Reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, and Kevin Robillard, Senior Politics Reporter for the Huffington Post. And today we're talking about the midterms. We still don't know who all of the winners are. As of right now, it looks like Stacey Abrams in Georgia is refusing to concede. And we're going to talk about that because, I mean, we're talking about massive voter suppression in Georgia. And that is so crucial to consistently talk about. We did see many firsts last night, lots of women, people of color. The Democrats did take back the House, but the Republicans tightened their grip on the Senate. And this gives them a lot of power to confirm even more conservative judges. So what did you make of last night? What questions do you have? What does this say about the state of this country and where we're going? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So let's talk about the significance. I mean, we're going to play a clip of Trump because the fact of the matter is he traveled to many places over the last 2 weeks. He said the most racist, xenophobic things, and his candidates in many cases won. He knocked off some Democratic senators. And the fact that they tighten their grip on the Senate really gives them so much power to confirm conservative judges. Kevin, why don't you take that one first? Talk about the significance of that.
Yeah, this is really the long-term problem for Democrats. You hear pundits talk about the Democrats' geography problem, and oftentimes that was meant in the context of the House, in that a lot of Democratic voters are packed into cities, and because of gerrymandering, Republicans are basically able to stuff all these voters into one Democratic district and then sort of barely win a lot of suburban districts. That is a situation Democrats can fix with new maps. And in some of the states, Democrats picked up new governorships, they'll be able to get new maps starting in 2020. But in the Senate, the average Senate seat is simply much more the average state is simply much more Republican, much more conservative, much older, and much whiter than the nation as a whole. And that is really a long-term problem for Democrats right now. They need to be able to win Senate seats in some of these very rural, older, whiter states. That's places like North Dakota, where Kevin Cramer really romped over Heidi Heitkamp, like Indiana, like Missouri, like Tennessee, which was a pickup opportunity for Democrats, but really ended up being not that close. In all of these places, the Republicans ran very Trump-aligned campaigns. some more so than others. In particular, Marsha Blackburn, Tennessee, ran, you know, a Trump copycat campaign, used the same incendiary rhetoric the president does. And so it's a really big problem for Democrats. John Tester surviving in Montana, that race was just called, helps loosen the blow of that. But this is something Democrats need to figure out if they want to stop Republicans from just putting these conservative judges on an assembly line and sending them through. And without a lot of legislative activity in the next 2 years, that's most of what the Senate is going to be doing.
And what's interesting is in many articles, Republicans off the record say that they were really angry because Trump continually talked about immigration using the most horrific terms rather than, I don't know, talking about health care or the economy, right? I mean, yes, the economy is doing well for the top 1%, but it's not doing well for so many other people in this country. I think we have to listen to what he said on the campaign trail. I mean, I was just reading an article from Andrew Craigie in The Atlantic called Inside the Alternative Universe of the Trump Rallies. Trump warns of a radical far-left Democratic switch and immigrant thugs in terms that bear little or no resemblance to the truth, and his voters can't get enough. I mean, over the last couple, actually just a week, he went to Fort Myers, Florida, Indianapolis, Chattanooga, Missouri, West Virginia, Montana, Florida, Georgia, Cleveland, and Missouri. And let's play a clip from one of his rallies, because this is what people voted for. This is a clip from Fox, October 13th in Kentucky.
One by one, we are finding the illegal alien criminals, predators, drug dealers, MS-13 killers, and we are sending them back home. We are liberating America's cities and towns. That's what we're doing. The only immigration policy Democrats support is catch and release. How about that one? You catch a criminal thug, you take the name, and then you release them. Say, please show up in 5 years to court. Now, number one, it's ridiculous. Number two, they never show up. What a mess. We have the dumbest immigration laws in the world. The world laughs at us, but we're getting them changed. We need some more Republicans. We need some votes.
That is Donald Trump speaking in Kentucky on October 13th. Arisha, we played that clip because people across this country are voting for that.
It's breathtaking. You know, a few years ago, I would have said that the fight of our generation was the corporate takeover of our democracy.
Yep.
Today, I would say that we are actually faced with a choice between the renormalization of this type of divisive and racist rhetoric and policies, or the choice to make those sorts of behaviors totally disqualifiable. Mm. We have dealt with October surprises that have included sexual assault claims on Supreme Court justices, major terrorist attacks, and a range of racist rhetoric and overt suppression tactics. All of this sort of language and policies is used as a way to divide people that have common interests, who want their families to be safe and healthy and educated. I think this is the fight that we are now faced with, whether this becomes the new normal again, or if we choose a different path.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll continue to talk about the significance of this. That's Arisha Hatch, Managing Director of Campaigns for Color of Change. Kevin Robillard is with the Huffington Post. Carrie Levine, Center for Public Integrity. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about this year's American Indian Film Festival in San Francisco. It is the 43rd annual festival that has advocated for so many years for authentic representation of Native people in the media. So what has really changed over four decades? We'll speak with filmmakers about the power of Native films. That's tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of the midterms. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're talking about the returns with Carrie Levine, senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity, Kevin Robillard, senior politics reporter with the Huffington Post, and Arisha Hatch, managing director of campaigns for Color of Change. Before we get to calls, and we'll see if we have a related call, if anyone would like to call in to talk about the significance of so many people voting for Donald Trump's xenophobic, racist message and what that really says about where we are right now, it's really important to discuss this. Carol Anderson, who is the author of One Person, No Vote, I'm pretty sure that's the name of it, voter suppression. She does an amazing job of that. She says that Donald Trump won the election because of voter suppression. She was on last week, and she was on Democracy Now! Last night, talking about Brian Kemp saying that Stacey Abrams was going to bring all of these, quote, illegals. And as she says, I hate that term, so do I. We don't use that term. She says we need to understand the power of this coded white language. It's very powerful. And we have to talk about the power of fear in this country and just how successful that is when Trump goes to these states and talks about this. Kevin, what would you add on this? I mean, I think it's just so important to talk about because he won in almost every state he visited.
Well, that's also because the White House sent him to states where Republicans were more likely to win. I think is a key point there. They did not send him to suburban Virginia, which is where the party had a number of really big losses. But that is, look, they sent him to where his base was. They sent him to places where the rural, older, white voters. And those are the people who are susceptible to his message. Those are the people who he managed to turn out to vote. You know, one of the incredible things was when the early returns were coming in Florida, Democrats really thought Andrew Gillum and Bill Nelson were both on track to win. In the case of Bill Nelson, there's still some hope that he could gain some votes in a recount. Gillum probably looks like he is done. And then what happened is these rural counties full of Trump voters really turned out in a really big way. And Trump is able to, you know, Democrats had a lot of energy. Trump was able to motivate his base to match that energy. And the way he does that is with, you know, basically racist appeals. And I think one thing that's important to note is every Trump rally exists sort of in its own alternate reality. Trump's rhetoric at times in the past week has really gone to a whole other level than even where he normally is. His rhetoric about the caravan in particular, yep, where he was suggesting that known criminals and people from the Middle East were in the caravan, that's completely untrue. The caravan is made up largely of women and children. It also remains several thousand miles, I believe, from the United States. Comparing it to an invasion is extremely over the top. The fact that he sent the military down to the border to deal with it was extremely over the top. Another example I'll use of this is Trump sort of on the voter suppression line. Trump said in a tweet earlier this week where he said law enforcement has been notified to be on the lookout for voter fraud. Various journalists looked into, you know, wait, which law enforcement? Who was notified? It doesn't appear there was any notice sent out to law enforcement to be on the lookout for voter fraud. It was just something Trump made up in a tweet.
And I just did the math in Florida. I mean, a lot of people live in Florida. Over 7 million people voted in Florida. Right now, we've got 99% reporting. And Ron DeSantis, the Republican, who said monkey up. I mean, so many racist things were said in that race. He's only ahead by 55,439 votes. I mean, that's not much. Yeah, and when you think about the fact that so many people with a record, 1.2 million people are going to be able to vote in the next election. We talked about this last night. That's going to be a game changer in Florida if they decide to vote.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of remarkable also that it was called Amendment 4 was what it was called on the ballot. The fact that it managed to pass with over 60% of the vote while both DeSantis and Rick Scott won is very interesting. You know, you think if you were someone who wanted to vote for Ron DeSantis, wouldn't support Amendment 4, but, you know, a good chunk of Floridians voted for both. And, you know, that's somewhat difficult to explain, but it is going to be a game changer for Democrats. They're going to have to do a lot of work registering all these people to vote. The exact process by which these people will get their rights restored, I believe, is still a little up in the air. So there's going to be have to be some work, likely from grassroots groups. The ACLU, I believe, has also stated they will probably get involved in working to sort of register these voters on the ground.
The ACLU also sent out information about discriminatory measures in the midterms. In Oregon, voters there defeated an anti-immigrant ballot measure that reaffirmed that no one should be targeted based on the color of their skin, their accent, or their perceived immigration status. Voters made it clear that the Raleigh area and Wake County in North Carolina would not aid Trump's deportation and detention force, and Kansans rejected promoting notorious anti-immigrant voter suppressor and Trump accomplice Kris Kobach's candidacy. That was a big one also. Before we get to calls, quickly, Arisha, you quickly mentioned the Amendment 4 in Florida. So many people who have served time in prison worked on this campaign. This was a really big victory, given that it got over 60% of the vote.
Yeah, it's a huge victory, and it was won because we centered the voices of the folks that were most impacted. And one of the things that we consistently heard from our folks who were knocking on doors in the ground and black communities and brown communities, even in white communities, was that there are a number of working class people who are impacted by our current system of mass incarceration. And so if we were talking to white folks, they would bring up the opioid crisis and how their family members or even themselves have been trapped in a cycle of incarceration. When we talk to black folks, and brown folks, every door we knocked on either was of a person that had been in the system of incarceration or that knew a close family member. And so they have seen firsthand how being trapped in the system, and even after you do your time and you exit and you're rehabilitated, even as you exit, the barriers that folks face to re-entering society, whether it's being able to rent an apartment or get a job or even vote, entrap people in a horrible cycle. And so that's why I think it resonated with more than 60% of folks in Florida. That's why I think the sort of right-wing legislature should be looking to implement it in a reasonable way, although we don't expect that to happen. And we expect continued fights to make sure that the will of the voters is actually implemented.
Yeah, and hopefully this will take off across the country, because the ACLU says that felony disenfranchisement laws prevent almost 6 million people from voting. That's a lot of potential voters there. That is Arisha Hatch, Managing Director of Campaigns for Color of Change. Kevin Robillard is senior politics reporter with the Huffington Post, and Carrie Levine is senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Graham in Redwood City. Hi, Graham. Welcome to the show.
Hi. What I'm not so necessarily surprised about is that the Democrats really haven't had a good message for the last 2 years. When you listen to Trump on the talk shows, he's able to define it, and then they cut away to the pundits, and the best pundits on MSNBC and the rest of it are all Republicans. Nancy Pelosi is not
so
there.
True.
She gave her acceptance speech, and it was like, oh, the Democrats have a plan? What is it? What is it on immigration? When you sound like this, champion ICE and getting rid of it, most people don't. They want some sort of immigration check coming. Most people are welcoming immigrants into the country, but there's a sort of national silence from the Democratic Party about what they believe. I think that allows Trump to define the conversation.
Graham, it's such a great point. I've been wanting to do a show about this, because some of these, you know, former hardcore Republicans who now cannot stand Trump, they are speaking with more passion and anger on MSNBC than the Democrats. Like Steve Schmidt, this is a guy who was working with McCain and Palin, and he talks with more passion about these issues. I mean, it's so bizarre. But Carrie, Graham makes a great point. All I hear from Democrats is we need comprehensive immigration reform, but they don't get detailed about it.
Right, and I think what you see is that Democrats are still really trying to speak with one voice on this issue. And so I think that that's been translating to the messaging. And certainly it's, you know, very difficult to think that with a divided Congress, we're going to get major immigration reform. Both parties, when they've had unified control of Congress, have not found a way to get that through. And so I think people like Graham are going to continue to be frustrated by that.
I mean, the Democrats obviously have defended the Dreamers, and they went to rallies with Dreamers. But Kevin, what else would you add on this? Where do Democrats stand on immigration at this time? Are they talking about people who are fleeing Central America to escape poverty, violence, to find a better life? I mean, so many reasons, but are they? I haven't heard them really say much about that.
Yeah, it was interesting. I did some reporting on this topic over the summer when the concept of abolishing ICE really grew in popularity among progressives. Mainstream Democrats really rejected that idea because they felt the current terms of the debate were ultimately fairly favorable to them. They believe that they can win a fight about the DREAM Act and, more specifically, a broader fight sort of about comprehensive immigration reform, about some type of deal where there'd be increased border security and people currently living in the United States without documentation would get a pathway to citizenship. They believe the terms of that fight are favorable to them. However, Trump has come up with different ways to sort of put them on the defensive, and they haven't always had a good response. The caravan, I think, is a very good example of this. Most Democrats, because seeing it as sort of an election week ploy, tried to more or less ignore the caravan. But the ones who did have to address it didn't always have a great message and response. You saw Claire McCaskill, the vulnerable Democratic senator in Missouri, essentially said, you know, whatever Trump wants to do with the caravan, I'm okay with. And that might be something you kind of have to say in a red state like that. But then in another red state, you saw Phil Bredesen, you know, made the simple fact that, you know, the caravan isn't a threat. It was, you know, a group of poor people coming to the United States. And the clip of him saying that was turned into an ad by his Republican opponent who portrayed it as an invasion. And it's a thing where Democrats don't yet have a coherent message to counter some of Trump's fear-mongering when it comes to Trump's ability to fire up his base. They can ultimately block Trump from doing the most egregious things. Most of those fights they'll win in the court of public opinion. If you look at the wall, for instance, the wall at this point is very unpopular in the broad swath of public opinion, but it's very, very popular with Trump's base. So this is a problem Democrats have, where they can usually win the fights, but sometimes at moments of high intensity, they don't always necessarily have the messaging to counter Trump's sort of fear-mongering on the issue of immigration.
That is Kevin Robillard, senior politics reporter for The Huffington Post. Carrie Levine is senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Arisha Hatch is managing director of campaigns for Color of Change. Today we're talking about election results and what they mean. The Democrats took the House. Republicans tighten their grip on the Senate. They're going to get a lot more power to confirm conservative judges. That is so incredibly significant. We've got a lot of firsts. A lot of progressives won. A lot of mainstream Democrats won. What are your thoughts on what you saw last night and what this says about where the country is and where we're going? We had a massive voter turnout, but still so many millions and millions of people did not bother to vote. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Yes, I'm trying to make it go viral. Prosecute Klepto Kemp. There's no way that somebody that's running for governor should be in charge of the voting list as Secretary of State. That's just complete corruption. And I would say that regardless of whatever results come in, he needs to be prosecuted. Also, because if we continue letting them get away with this, they're going to keep doing it. Also, the fact that Nancy Pelosi is again going to be speaker, or supposedly going to be speaker, is not very encouraging. And instead of looking towards the trying to gain Trump voters, I think the Democratic Party, this proved beyond any doubt that the Democratic Party needs to start looking to the left, especially to the younger voters, who are the ones, the younger and people of color, who are the ones that have been bringing the victories.
Well, thank you so much. Going back to Carol Anderson, who is chair of the African American Studies Department at Emory University, we had her on last week. We're going to have her on again in the near future. last night on Democracy Now, she gave out some very important numbers. She says, we cannot forget that Kemp purged just in the last 2 years 10.6% of registered voters in Georgia. That is 10% of voters in the entire state just in 2 years. She said, we cannot forget that he closed 214 polling places, most of those in minority and poor neighborhoods. Kemp has held, in this round alone, 53,000 registered voters, 70% African American. So I did the math again. Currently, Stacey Abrams in Georgia is not stepping down. She's not conceding. And she is behind by only 64,313 votes, okay? Think about that number, 64,000 votes. So 53,000 registered voters, gone. 10% of voters in the last 2 years, gone. Arisha, I mean, this should be illegal. It's just incredible that this is happening.
Yeah, we believe it is illegal, and that's why we're so proud of Stacey for not conceding. You know, I think what has gotten lost in all of the hoopla that Trump and so many other Republican candidates are creating right now is that we have had an attack on our voting systems in this country, and there is a complete lack of transparency about what has happened and what the threats are. I think it was Sunday, Brian Kemp was claiming that there was an attempt to hack the voter registration system. He talked about some of the purges. He himself had trouble voting because of the exact match system. And it's incredible that this man could run for the governor of a state while holding this position. For anyone that thinks that there shouldn't be further investigations, I think that there is ample evidence that this election has been tampered with in a way, and the public deserves to know exactly what happened and exactly the implications.
Well, and we also need to call this for what it is. I mean, of the 214 polling places that he closed for no reason, most of them are in poor neighborhoods and in neighborhoods where mostly people of color live. Of the 53,000 registered voters, 70% are black. And last night, I don't know if we still have this clip. We don't have the clip. I mean, this is just horrific. Greg Palast interviewed a 92-year-old Georgia voter, Christine Jordan. This woman has voted in Georgia since 1968. And yesterday, she went to the polls to find out that she was purged from the rolls. Her granddaughter was crying, saying that her grandma held civil rights meetings in her home. And today, to come out and not be able to vote is extremely emotional. She says, it bothers me to my core. There was no explanation. So this woman, Christine Jordan, who's 92, has been voting since 1968. There's no record of her voting in any election whatsoever. This is an assumption on my part, but I'm guessing that this 92-year-old black woman was going to vote for Stacey Abrams, the first black woman to vote to run for governor in Georgia, and she couldn't do that. Arisha, I mean, this is just one of how many stories that we're not going to hear about.
It's a devastating story, and it should shock the moral conscience of all Americans. You know, I think Stacey is the candidate of hope and change for Georgia, and it is unfortunate to watch what's playing out here, but I am, and Color of Change PAC is so proud to stand with her as she continues to fight. Because this is just wrong what's happened here.
And Carrie, what are your thoughts about media coverage of this? I just don't want this to die down. It seems like we talk about voter suppression and these kinds of acts that really affect directly poor communities and people of color just around election time. But what, I mean, the media has a responsibility to continue the story so this doesn't continue to happen.
That's correct. In election administration and the rules governing election aren't the most glamorous story in the world all the time, but they are important. I actually spent a big chunk of the summer and fall reporting on the barriers that keep Native American voters in North Dakota from the ballot box. The voter turnout there on reservations has long been low. There's many factors driving that. There's poverty. There's the effect of treatment over generations, broken promises on people's trust in government. But while I was reporting the piece, one of the things that happened is that lawsuits over North Dakota's voter identification requirements reached actually the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court in September and October. And between the primary and the general election in North Dakota, voter identification requirements went into effect that meant that ID that people used to vote in the primary there couldn't be used to vote in the general because the new requirement said you had to have a residential street address. You couldn't use a post office box mailing address. So if your ID had that, you could no longer use it to vote in the general election. And a lot of people on the reservations in North Dakota use PO boxes for their address. Mm-hmm. So this decision prompted a huge scramble by the tribes who issued thousands of free identification cards to meet the new requirements so that members could vote. And you actually saw yesterday record turnout on North Dakota reservations. The official results are still coming in, but the unofficial results suggest there was a record turnout because the tribes and some nonprofits poured resources into helping people turn out and vote in a way that really is just about unprecedented, but they can't afford to do that for every election.
Right.
The tribes took resources that go to other things and used them to issue these free, identification cards to members to have transportation to the polls in these rural areas. One thing that has to be clear is those were resources that came from somewhere. They may not be able to do that every time. And litigation over this requirement and what the tribes had to do to comply with it, to help their members comply with it, is probably going to continue. But I think that you're right. A lot of people were paying attention to that story because there was a hot Senate race in North Dakota. And once there's not, I think there is an obligation to keep covering what these decisions mean for people's ability to vote.
Right. We have an email, and we're going to continue to follow that. In fact, tomorrow we're going to talk about the American Indian Film Festival in San Francisco. So we'll talk more about that, and we'll talk about the Native American women who won last night. We have an email from Tim who says, excuse me, I'm relieved that my Social Security will not disappear and that I might actually be able to get Medicare. Let's hope, Tim. Cautiously optimistic that the Democrats will realize that they have to go progressive. For too long, the Democrats have been running on, we're not as bad as them. It's time to push for real positions. Medicare for all and rebuild the U.S. infrastructure would probably be enough to turn the Senate in 2020. Thank you for that email, Tim. Let's hear from Matt in Pacifica, who's got a related comment. Hi, Matt. Hi, do we have Matt? Hi, Matt.
I just wanted to, talk about, I honestly think that the majority of the country, or close to the majority of the country, kind of obviously doesn't agree with Trump, but doesn't necessarily even agree with the Republican Party. But I think that the Democrats just have a real organization issue, and I think that they have an issue with just kind of figuring out what their base is and what their base is leaning towards. I think if we look at races like Feinstein last night with DeLeon, like, I think they have a big separation with the younger, more progressive Democrats that are coming up and being really active, and then they're older, you know, the older Democrats that are still voting for the Feinstein, still voting for their polo, you know, and supporting the Pelosi's. And I think these younger 18 to 29 year olds, and even, you know, myself, I'm 31, like this group of people want these more left-leaning, want these more progressive candidates. And we're seeing these races where even in the Democratic Party, the Democrats are split because we have this separation in the Democratic Party. And because the Democrats don't have a message, they can't organize amongst themselves and they can't figure out what direction they're headed. And I think, you know, it killed them in 2016. And it kind of, while it didn't kill us last night, I think it really, it's really hurting their ability to actually have that blue wave and actually be able to make momentum and move forward.
It's so true, and it seems like, you know, the mainstream Dems are always late to the party. I mean, when you look at Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke lost by just 213,750 votes. More than 8 million people voted in Texas. You know, he came so close, and he was a staunch progressive on stage. I mean, Arisha, I have to say, what was amazing to me about Beto O'Rourke, and we only have a couple minutes, he talked more about issues affecting black voters than almost any politician I have seen. I mean, he talked constantly about health care, about reproductive rights, maternity care, racial justice. I mean, it was pretty incredible to see that in a state like Texas.
It was, and I think it's one of the reasons that made him competitive, that inspired a sense of vision and hope for many Texans who live in a state where there is a lack of investment in the progressive infrastructure, like Georgia, like many other parts in the South, that Democrats have totally conceded to the right wing, despite majorities of people of color. And, you know, I think Beto, while he didn't win, is the type of candidate that we want to see. He's the type of candidate of the future. And, you know, I think he has the potential to be a transformative figure in American politics. But I do want to add that I think, you know, I understand, and Color of Change PAC is an independent organization that runs independent of parties. And we have a number of frustrations and campaigns against the Democratic Party and Democratic elected officials. I don't think it's all about message, though. I do think that we have to remind ourselves that in all of these fights, we are underfunded, that we are the Davids. Because we are not seeking to preserve the status quo. We're reaching for an alternative vision of the world. So I agree with a lot of the sentiments about message discipline and message focus. But I also think it's important to remind folks that when you're fighting, changing something is more difficult than keeping it the same.
Yeah, and we'll definitely do shows on that. Arisha Hatch is Managing Director of Campaigns for Color of Change. Kevin Robillard is Senior Politics Reporter for the Huffington Post. Carrie Levine is Senior Political Reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Great to be on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And thanks to Laura Winnes for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.